cost of crude heads back up, does that make higher prices at the pump inevitable?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. We've got the global perspective for you this hour, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Interested in buying a barrel of crude oil? Well, in New York, it'll set you back more than $101 this morning. Price is about a dollar higher, mostly the result of a chaotic OPEC meeting in Vienna. The oil cartel rejected international calls to pump more oil, and in fact, the summit ended so badly, some called it the worst OPEC meeting ever. That's not good news for consumers. Joining us live from London is Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Good morning, Stephen. Are prices at the pump likely to head back up now?
Oh, absolutely. It's reckoned for every $1 increase in the price of a barrel of oil, that'll mean an extra 2.5 cents a gallon at the pumps. Overall, that $1 increase will cost U.S. consumers $1 billion a year. And it's worth noting, Bob, most of the recessions in the West were largely triggered by a sharp rise in the price of crude.
You know, after the meeting, though, Stephen, Saudi Arabia actually announced they'd pump their own oil and boost production. In theory, that should lower prices, yes?
Yes, but there's an interesting point here from Philip Verliger, a veteran oil industry watcher. He says the Saudis are playing a double game. Under pressure from the U.S., they go to the OPEC meeting, they call for an increase in output to put a lid on oil prices. But with rather less fanfare, they cut the discounts that refineries get when they buy Saudi oil. So the Saudis are actually pushing up the price of oil. So Philip Verliger says, yes, they're happy to pump more oil, but at a higher price.
They're not in the business of providing oil cheaply to the United States or to any other consumers. They're in the same business as you and I are in trying to maximize our wealth. They just do it quietly rather than very publicly.
And he says the Saudis have brilliantly managed the price of oil since March 1999, when it was just $10 a barrel.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. See if you can find us some better news next time, huh?
Okay, Bob.
Let's see what those oil numbers are doing to these numbers. Oil prices are weighing on markets around the world, and it's a mixed bag in Europe this hour. London has nudged up a small fraction of a percent this morning. Paris stocks have added a tenth of a percent, but shares in Frankfurt have shaved off a tiny fraction. Here's your morning inspirational message. Gasoline futures for July have lost a penny, slipping to $2.98 a gallon. Don't get your hopes up, though. That's not going to show up at the pump in our lifetimes. Later this morning, the USDA will release its estimates of global food supplies. Some analysts expect corn reserves to be at their lowest level since the 1970s. And the floods in the Midwest aren't helping. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrienne Hill reports.
The rising Missouri River is threatening hundreds of thousands of acres of corn and soybeans in the Midwest. Land that
is among the most productive farmland in the country.
John Anderson is a senior economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. He says it's too early to know the damage the water will cause, but analysts are watching this flood closely because
corn stocks are at a historically tight level.
I ask analyst Darren Newsom from Telvent DTN why the rest of us should care about corn supply. He says it's quite simple. Corn is in nearly everything food-related.
In some way, shape, or form, most everything agricultural or food that we eat or items that we buy can be traced sooner or later back to corn.
Our soda has corn syrup, our beef eats corn, and on and on. So it goes like this. The bigger the flood, the tighter the corn supply. The tighter the corn supply, the higher the cost of corn. And the higher the cost of corn, the more we pay for our groceries. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at Manta.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu.
Heads up, horse racing fans. A field of 12 3-year-olds has just been entered for this Saturday's Belmont Stakes. The 2-for-1 favorite, a horse named Animal Kingdom. Wherever in the animal kingdom do these names come from anyway? That's what Chris Kaltenbach wondered. He's a writer for the Baltimore Sun, and he's been looking into how these famous horses get their names. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Bob.
There's actually an official process for naming thoroughbreds?
There is. All proposed names have to go through the Jockey Club. About 70% of all names that are submitted are approved, but that leaves about 30% that aren't. You can't have more than 18 letters in a name. You can't name a horse after a racetrack. So, you know, regrettably, we won't have a horse named I Love Pimlico anytime soon. You can't name a horse after a horse that's still alive. You can't name a horse after anybody who has won one of the Triple Crown races. So there are rules. And you have to be tasteful, which is the one, I guess, that people tend to run afoul of sometimes.
Now, is there anything to suggest that how they pick names has any effect on how bettors pick horses?
I don't know if there's been any studies, but you know that anybody who bets the horses is always looking for something, some hint, some lucky charm or whatever. So I suspect that there are people who look at names, and you always hear the legends of, you know, somebody who wins $1 million because they saw a horse named after their grandfather and decided to bet the house on it.
Some of these are not so great when you're a track announcer. For example, Yakka Hikka Mikadola.
Yakka Hikka Mikadola. That's a name that will go down in history primarily because poor Tom Durkin, when he was calling a race, just could not wrap his mouth around that name. Each time he tried to pronounce it, it became worse. And so by the end of the race, he was just Yakka Makka Lika Makka Luka. Yeah, he just didn't even try anymore. So pretty hilarious.
Any rules about this? Is there a future for corporate sponsorship of horse names, maybe like race cars?
I don't know if we have a horse named Valvoline anytime soon. I'm not sure what the Jockey Club's position is on that, but I think they would look down their nose at it.
But Yakka Hikka Mikadola is just fine with them.
Yakka Hikka Mikadola and Flat Fleet Feet.
Easy for you to say. Chris Kaltenbach is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun. He's been looking into how all these horses get their names. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
By the way, we've pulled up the YouTube video to hear how that notorious racing call for Yakka Hikka Mikadola really sounded. Here's a sample.
And Hikka Makka Rakadakalola, and the homeroom jester, and the trailer is Dola Rola Rola Rakadaka Molahola.
Want to hear that again? Find the link at marketplace.org. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
In China, one school is trying to revolutionize its curriculum by introducing indie rock.
They just start the rock band. To be perfectly honest with you, I've heard them. They're not very good, but it's something that they love doing.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Out goes memorization, in comes fun. That's next time on Marketplace from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.